From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
It's a great thing to do because we have an invasion of drugs, invasion of gangs, invasion of people, and it's unacceptable.
Well, that was one of the justifications President Trump offered on Friday when he declared a national emergency on the southern border in order to divert federal funds to build a wall. Now the expected legal challenges are coming, and even the president expects this declaration to be decided in the courts. But Congress could have its say, too, if it wants. It is, after all, its power of the purse that the president has seized. Now, presidents have declared national emergencies before, of course, but the particulars of this moment are spurring debate over the constitutionality of the president's actions and Congress's role as it continues to hand power to the executive. This hour on Point, the president's emergency declaration and where it takes us now. And you can join us. What do you think? Did the president do what had to be done to get past Congress to build a wall? Is this a power grab by President Trump that breaks with American tradition and law? Or is it just a show for his base that is serves a political purpose, but perhaps not a legal one? Where do you think this will go? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And later on in the hour, we will turn our attention to former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe and his 60 Minutes interview last night about the FBI and President Trump. But first, let's dive into an exploration of President Trump's national emergency. And joining me from Washington is Paula Reed, CBS News correspondent covering the Justice Department, the White House, and legal affairs. Paula, it's good to have you.
Oh, so glad to be back.
Okay, so first of all, Paula, we heard over the weekend the beginnings of the White House sort of mounting its defense of President Trump's actions on Friday. What pushback have we been hearing from, say, folks like Stephen Miller about why they think this was the right thing to do?
Well, they continue to use the same talking points the president used in his Rose Garden press conference on Friday. They talk about an invasion. They talk about drugs coming across the border in droves, killing tens of thousands of Americans. And they say this is a national emergency. But that belies a lot of the facts from the president's own agencies. The fact that most drugs come into this country through legal ports of entry, they would not necessarily be stopped by a wall. The fact that border crossings are historically down, in particular over the past few years. So the idea that there is actually an invasion or an emergency, a lot of these claims just don't match the facts. But that doesn't mean that the president doesn't have legitimate national security, national emergency powers that he's trying to tap into here.
Right. So, you know, I mentioned Stephen Miller, White House senior advisor. He was on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace, and they locked horns quite ferociously because Chris Wallace insisted on clarification from Stephen Miller about these justifications for declaring this national emergency. So let's listen.
Then answer my question. Can you name one case where a president has asked Congress for money, Congress has refused, and the president has then invoked national powers to get the money anyway?
Well, this current situation...
Just yes or no, sir.
The current situation pertains specifically to the Military Construction Authority.
I'm just asking, has there been a single case where Congress asked for money for military construction, Congress said no, and
The meaning of the statute, Chris, is clear on its own terms. If you don't like the statute, or members of Congress don't like the statute...
Would you agree the answer is no? There hasn't been a single case like this.
So that was Stephen Miller on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace. Paula Reed, respond to that. I mean, Wallace really pushing Miller there about there hasn't been a single case like this, as far as he could see, in U.S. history so far.
Well, that's right. I mean, presidents have historically granted national emergencies for many different things. It is common, as the White House likes to say, but the way it's being used here is not common. This power was granted to the president so that he or she could respond quickly in an emergency situation if Congress couldn't act quickly enough. You know, some people have sort of called this an end run around Congress. Well, yeah, kind of it is. The problem is you have a harder time in court making your case about a national emergency when it does appear that really what you're doing is trying to just circumvent Congress completely. And it wasn't that there was an exigency. And that's really the problem that they're going to have here. They've been debating this in Congress for quite some time. The president even said in his Rose Garden press conference, quote, I didn't need to do this, but I wanted it to go faster. And it's the fact that instead of responding to an emergency, he's actually just trying to go around Congress. that's going to be the big, that's going to be the gist of their legal challenge in court.
Well, so let's listen to that moment, because many legal observers pointed to exactly the moment you're talking about, Paula, as saying like that may be the first graph in the complaints that will be filed or expected to be filed against this national emergency declaration. So here's the president on Friday saying that perhaps, no, this isn't an emergency.
I want to do it faster. I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I didn't need to do this, but I'd rather do it much faster. And I don't have to do it for the election. I've already done a lot of wall for the election.
That's the president on Friday. Paula Reid, you know, a little bit later, we're going to talk about exactly, you know, how Congress is approaching this moment and what it could or couldn't do, given the statutes here that the president is relying on. But talk to us a little bit about the legal challenges. There's, you know, the state of California is talking about partnering with other states to file challenges. There's one from a legal watchdog, one from a group that's actually sued the Justice Department on Friday itself, saying the Justice Department hasn't provided the customary legal memorandums in supporting the national emergency declaration.
That's right. They're coming from every conceivable angle, a public citizen, an advocacy group. They've sued on behalf of landowners whose land needs to be seized before this construction can begin. Crew, they have sued to the Justice Department. They want the legal opinions. Now, my sources have confirmed that this executive action, these national emergency declarations, these did go through the Justice Department and the Office of the White House Counsel. Now, California and New York, along with a couple other blue states, are going to band together. They've also said they intend to file suits. And the ACLU also getting in the action, saying, look, this isn't a legitimate military interest. This is not how you should use your power. Now, in addition to the legal challenges, they also have political challenges. So the House Judiciary Committee said they're also going to investigate this as part of their ongoing effort to investigate pretty much every aspect that's up for grabs of the Trump administration. Now, the question is, will they prevail at the Supreme Court? Everyone involved in this case expects there to be legal challenges, and they expect that there will be at least one or two nationwide injunctions against this at the outset. This is nothing new. We've seen this with the president's travel ban, separation of families policy. We have seen this when the president attempts to act sort of at the edges of his executive power. But when this eventually makes its way through the federal courts, I mean, the question is whether or not, A, the president's own words in the Rose Garden can and will be used against them. We've seen that in the lower courts. It remains to be seen whether or not the Supreme Court would also do that. But again, will he be granted broad deference for what is and is not an emergency, and whether or not he's perhaps gone too far this time just trying to circumvent the legislative process? Again, we're really in uncharted territory here.
Right. And then there's a big discussion to be had about how the federal courts, and especially the Supreme Court, has looked at questions of executive power. But even the president himself, Paula, as you know, on Friday anticipated that this is exactly the path that his emergency declaration is going to follow. Here's what he said.
I'll sign the final papers as soon as I get into the Oval Office, and we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there. And we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court.
President Donald Trump on Friday. Paula Reid, stand by for a moment, because I want to bring into the conversation Stephen Vladeck. He's joining us from Austin, Texas. He's a constitutional lawyer and professor at the University of Texas School of Law. Professor Vladeck, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, respond to what you just heard in that clip from President Trump on Friday. Is he right? Is his national emergency declaration very likely to end up before the United States Supreme Court?
I mean, I think the short answer is yes. I think Paul is right that, you know, one way or the other, these cases are going to make their way through the courts. It's hard to guess now, though, exactly which case is going to be the one that gets there and in which configuration. I mean, there's so many different potential avenues on which the emergency declaration could be challenged. You know, once the president actually starts trying to take specific concrete actions toward building the wall with some of the money he activated by declaring a national emergency, I think we'll see, you know, more lawsuits challenging those authorities more directly. So, you know, I think if the question is, will this somehow get to the Supreme Court at some point, I think the answer is probably yes. But, you know, it's hard to say in advance exactly which case and why and what it's going to look like by the time it gets there.
Right. And so but the particulars of the case that does make it to the Supreme Court really matter here, because from what I understand, there seems to be some agreement, even if it's reluctant, that the president, I mean, has the president acted constitutionally? I mean, presidents have powers to declare national emergencies, and I don't see anything in the statutes that allow for it that specify what constitutes a national emergency and what doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the things that folks are really surprised to discover when they first read about the National Emergencies Act, is that Congress, when it passed the statute in 1976, didn't actually try to define what would and what would not count as an emergency. I think recognizing quite correctly that Congress couldn't anticipate every single possible thing that would befall us that would require the president to be able to act so quickly. When the statute was initially enacted, the idea was that the, you know, constraint on the scope of an emergency would come entirely from political checks, from Congress's ability under the original statute to simply terminate a national emergency through majority votes of both houses. One of the problems is that about 7 years later, the Supreme Court said that kind of legislative veto is unconstitutional, and Congress responded in 1985 by saying, all right, instead of majority houses, majority votes of both houses, we'll have to pass a new statute. Of course, that requires the president's signature, or assuming a veto, it requires a veto-proof supermajority of both houses. So the threshold for overriding an emergency declaration has become much more impossible to meet, I think, compared to 43 years ago when Congress passed the statute. I think that's why so much attention right now has shifted to the courts.
And look, Stephen Miller this weekend, in talking to Chris Wallace, he basically asserted that the president would veto such a thing. And so where does that leave Congress?
Well, I mean, I still think there's a lot of value in Congress going on record. I mean, I think there's no question that if this goes to a vote in the House will vote to terminate this national emergency. And then that puts a lot of pressure on Republicans in the Senate. The way the National Emergencies Act is written, Congress, once one House votes, basically has to act. And so one way or the other, we'll find out where Senate Republicans stand, even if there's not enough votes to meet that veto override threshold.
Well, Stephen Vladeck, stand by for a moment. And Paula Reed, hang in there with us. We're talking about President Trump's national emergency declaration on the southern border, its constitutionality, and the legal challenges it is going to be facing. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about President Donald Trump's declaration of a national emergency on the southern border, the legal challenges that that declaration is and will continue to face, and also Congress's role here with the power ever growing in the executive in the United States. We're joined today by Paula Reed. She's CBS News correspondent covering the Justice Department, the White House, and legal affairs. Stephen Vladeck also joins us. He's a constitutional lawyer and law professor at the University of Texas. Let's listen to some response that we heard from politicians over the weekend. This is Democratic Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. He told Margaret Brennan of CBS's Face the Nation yesterday that he believes Congress should fight to defend the legislative branch's constitutional powers.
I do think, Margaret, we should take action to disapprove of this excessive use of executive power and make it clear that the Article I branch, the Congress, is going to jealously defend our right to be the body that decides on federal spending and not let the president use this extreme measure as an end around our appropriations process.
That's Democratic Senator Chris Coons. In an interview with CBS's Face the Nation yesterday, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham defended President Trump's decision to divert funds from military housing and middle school construction budgets in order to build the wall.
But let's just say for a moment that he took some money out of the military construction budget. I would say it's better for the middle school kids in Kentucky to have a secure border. We'll get them the school they need. But right now, we got a national emergency on our hands.
Senator Lindsey Graham there also yesterday. Well, joining us now is Claire Finkelstein. She teaches national security law at the University of Pennsylvania and is the director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. Claire Finkelstein, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So give us your take here. Do you see the president's declaration as a lawful one?
It's not lawful. And there are two parts of the analysis. One has to do with the declaration of the emergency itself. Does he have the power to issue an emergency that probably he himself doesn't even believe is an emergency? And then the second half has to do with use of the funds. Is it permissible for him to redirect funds from military construction projects, narcotics, and other sorts of priorities? Legal scholars have been surprised to hear over the last couple days have been saying, yeah, he probably has the power to declare an emergency, but most of the challenges will come from the second prong, the use of the funds. But I think it's not so clear that he does have that power to issue an emergency when he has admitted that there's no emergency. And that, you know, to imagine this, imagine that we had a letter. We discovered a letter that he had written to Mitch McConnell. You know, dear Mitch, you and I know there's no emergency, but we really need to do this to get reelected in 2020. Should we go for it? You know, if there were very, very clear evidence that in his own belief there was no emergency, it'd be very hard to see a court supporting the use of the Emergencies Act under those circumstances.
Well, as we pointed out, I mean, many people are saying he did exactly that. It may not be written in a letter, but he said it on Friday when he said he didn't have to do this.
That's right. So the question that we really need to ask on the first prong is, do you really believe that the 1976 Emergencies Act extends to the power to declare a sham emergency, which the president is actually admitting is not a real emergency?
Okay. So, Paula Reed, you've been waiting patiently here. Let me bring you back in. What do you think about what Claire Finkelstein has said? I mean, did the president potentially deep six his own declaration right there on Friday?
Well, he definitely made it a lot harder. I was in the Rose Garden for the speech. I was sitting right behind the new Attorney General, William Barr. And when the president said this, I sort of just looked at William Barr to see if he, like, flinched or, you know, reacted, because this is going to make the lawyers at the Justice Department's job a lot harder. I don't think it's game over for this, but it certainly made it more difficult. And it's interesting when you look at the breakdown in funding. The majority of the funding that he has sought is tied to a national emergency. But then there is several hundred million dollars that is not necessarily tied to a national emergency declaration. It's just used through executive action. So it does seem that there's a little bit of a belt and suspenders effort here in case it's proven that he cannot declare a national emergency. There is some other money. So when he hits the campaign trail in 2020, at least he can say, oh, I had to use executive action and the courts took some of my money, but I got this other little pool of money. But of course, it's nowhere near the $5.7 billion he was seeking.
Right. So, Stephen Vladeck, let me turn back to you here, because on this issue of the scope of executive power, I mean, that was one of the areas of focus in during the time where we were looking at Supreme Court nominees and then the people that the president might name to the Supreme Court. And so historically, you know, the people were saying, hey, look, the president is likely to name people to the court who have an expansive view of executive power. Is that not what happened?
I mean, it is what happened. But I think, you know, Meg, that the key here is Congress has largely shot itself in the foot. And, you know, whether folks are sympathetic to Professor Finkelstein's view or not, I think the president is not going to be coming to the courts arguing that he's doing this solely based on his inherent constitutional authority under Article 2. Mm-hmm. Those are the arguments that I think, you know, folks generally associate with Justice Kavanaugh, with Justice Gorsuch. Rather, his claim is going to be that he's doing exactly what Congress authorized, for better or for worse, in 1976 when it passed the National Emergencies Act, in this more specific military construction statute, Section 2808 of Title 10 of the U.S. Code. And I think the problem is that argument, you know, the politics of it and the optics of it are really ugly because the president has basically said he didn't need to do it. But the law doesn't turn on necessity. I mean, right. I think we all assume that when Congress gives the president the power to declare a national emergency, there's a baked-in requirement that the action be necessary. Nothing in the statute says that. And so I think that's why courts are going to gravitate toward the thing that looks more familiar to them, which is, as Professor Finkelstein put it, the second part, whether the specific authorities the president's using are actually meant to be used for the purposes he's using them.
Right. So I want to explore this question of Congress abdicating sort of its power as the Article One branch of government here. But Claire Finkelstein, about this use of funds question, let's talk about that for another moment here. Because if I remember correctly, this weekend, Stephen Miller said, well, look, we might be able to justify the use of Defense Department funds on the border to build more barrier or wall because, conveniently, there are troops already deployed there. So it would be in support of U.S. military forces already on the border. Therefore, it is legal.
Right. So as Adam Schiff commented, right, first you convince people there's a fake emergency, then you send troops down to deal with the fake emergency, and then you say, well, there are troops there, so we have to protect them by building a wall. And, I mean, that just, you know, obviously is a whole false narrative. And the idea that now we can appropriate funds that are really necessary for military purposes elsewhere, rather critical military purposes, as well as funds that ironically were appropriated originally by Congress to combat narcotics coming through legal ports of entry, which is where most of them come through. Obviously, there's a real question of priorities here and whether or not we're defunding efforts that supposedly protect the very things that the wall is supposed to protect.
Right. But so that question of, you know, a question of priorities and the reliance on political solutions, which weren't baked into the cake in legal statutes. I mean, to Stephen Vladeck's overall point here, the legal mechanisms to stop this for people who want to stop it, he sees as simply not there because historically it's been the realm of politics and congressional action to perhaps push back on the president. Will that happen now?
And we have to interpret the president's powers here in terms of what is allowed under Article 2 and what is traditionally the realm of Congress under Article 1 and required under Article 1, namely the power of the purse. So arguably, if you interpret both the Emergencies Act and the various statutes like 2808, as Steve mentioned, as allowing the president to do this, it's an unconstitutional delegation from Congress to the president of the power of the purse. I think that's extremely problematic from the standpoint of separation of powers and extremely problematic from the standpoint of the scope of the president's authority under Article 2.
Stephen Vladeck, respond to that.
Well, I mean, I'm sympathetic, and I think, you know, again, the optics of this are so bad that it feels a little bit sort of uncomfortable to try to argue against what Professor Finkelstein just said. There's this old thing called the non-delegation doctrine, which, you know, was especially in vogue the last time we saw this kind of conservative majority in the Supreme Court in the 1930s. And the idea behind the non-delegation doctrine is exactly what, you know, Claire says. It's the idea that Congress can't give its power to the president in this manner. The problem is that the non-delegation doctrine has been dead for 82 years, largely at the same time that we've seen the rise of the modern administrative state. And so, you know, if we really want to have a broader conversation about reviving the non-delegation doctrine, I think we have to be careful about the collateral damage because, you know, much of the modern administrative regulatory apparatus in this country depends upon the demise of the non-delegation doctrine. Congress has gotten very comfortable delegating most of its authority to the executive branch. I think what's different here, Meghna, is that we're not used to this kind of delegation being used in such a transparently pretextual manner.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the National Emergencies Act has been on the book for 43 years. There have been dozens of emergencies, but never one where the president was so clearly using this authority as a backdoor around Congress's refusal to give him more directly what he wanted.
Right.
So I think the question for all of us is, given that, should the answer be to completely rethink constitutional separation of powers doctrine, or should the answer be to try to impel Congress to reclaim its authority in this area, whether by overriding this particular declaration, by building into the National Emergencies Act going forward some kind of sunset so that the president can't just do this and rely on congressional acquiescence? That's the broader conversation. I think it's one that we're not just having about emergencies. I mean, this is in many ways a deep parallel to the conversation about war powers in this country,
Well, okay.
where where we've seen the same erosion of Congress's authority.
So I want to turn exactly this issue back to Claire Finkelstein and Paula Reid as well. And Claire, first, let me start with you. I mean, I think this is like one of the core questions of the moment that we've been looking at, basically a historical slow motion abdication of that Congress has been going through of its powers as a co-equal branch of government, sometimes very willingly so when it serves the interests of whatever party is in power in Congress. So do you see, though, is this a moment, a potential turning point moment where Congress might say, okay, no, maybe we should actually, as Stephen Vladeck was saying, come up with some congressional fixes to reclaim our Article I authority?
Absolutely. I think what's so unprecedented here is that we have a president who is in our faces saying, there is no emergency. This is all pretextual, and yet I have the power to do it. And we're here getting the results of years and years of not only congressional but judicial deference to the executive branch, particularly after 9/11, we see such a growth in this. So when people point back to Obama's use of the emergency power and Bush's use of the emergency power, it is true that since the 1976 Emergencies Act, there have been an enormous number of emergencies declared, sometimes not in transparently emergency situations. However, clearly, in those cases, at least, the president who invoked them believed that there was an urgent need to solve something and a situation where Congress had not previously spoken to the matter. Mm. So when we have a president who is transparently using his emergency powers to obviate Congress's power, that's where there has to be some kind of logic of non-delegation left in order to ensure that Congress is in its lane and the president is in his lane and that the one is not taking over the powers of the other.
Well, let's listen to Republican Representative Tom Reed of New York and his view on things. He was speaking to reporters after the president's announcement on Friday.
I've encouraged the president not to go down this path of a national emergency. I mean, I see the legal basis. I see the legal argument that he's deploying to get access to these funds in order to secure the border. But fundamentally, this should be Congress's role. And what I am afraid of is this lets Congress off the hook from doing its job.
That's Republican Representative Tom Reed of New York. Paula Reid, though, let me turn back to you, because is it not fair to be a little dubious of Congress and its overall desire to, as Claire was saying, redefine the lanes or strengthen the lanes between the branches here? Because I'm not even sure that there are the votes to override a presidential veto if indeed they try to bring the National Security Declaration to an end.
Well, that's where it gets really interesting, because then Republicans have to decide whether or not they want to look hypocritical because they vilified President Obama for his expansive use of executive power. And to endorse this would certainly look hypocritical. And you also have to remember that this money, somebody else was expecting it to come to their district. Mm-hmm. So it could be by the end of this long game, it's not about, the law or the Constitution. It's about, Senator Lindsey Graham was talking about that school. And he's like, Jimmy, we'll get your school built. Yeah, how's that going to go over with Billy's mom and dad? The fact is that representatives expect a lot of this money to be coming to their district for specific projects. And when you start to divert it for a wall, then you're going to have not only all these legal problems that are coming out of every corner, you're going to have some big political problems too, because these representatives and the constituents are going to be upset.
Well, let's quickly go to the phones here. Let's go to Jamie, who's calling from Caribou, Maine. Jamie, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for taking my call. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Go ahead, Jamie.
Yep. Okay. My comment is this, and just what your speaker was just talking about there. I'm tired of this, and I just think, why don't we just let it happen? And what do they think? Let the chips fall where they may, call his bluff, then all the mess, the chaos that's going to ensure from that is going to be his problem. Right now, he has his out by saying he expects the courts to be taking it over. No, let it happen. Just let him go ahead and do it and let the absolute mess of the chaos of this mess fall completely and directly on him.
Well, Jamie, thank you for your call. Paula Reid, let me turn back to you since you were just talking about that. I mean, would it be chaotic, as Jamie says?
It's unclear. There's always chaos, right?
Yeah.
Chaos is a guarantee. I cover the Justice Department, Mueller, and the Trump administration. Chaos. Chaos is my beat. But again, it's because he's playing at the edges of executive power. And that has been tested in the courts. And he likes to say he'll win at the Supreme Court because that's what happened with his travel ban, speaking of chaos. But he prevailed on after multiple iterations, after that was revised, after
right.
it was altered.
Right.
It's unclear whether or not he can do this here, sort of go back and try to tweak those numbers a little bit to eke this through both legally and politically. But chaos is a guarantee, especially when you go about things this way, which is, look, I'll try to see if this works. That does feel like what they're doing, right?
Mm.
Nothing else worked. Republicans who were completely opposed to this finally just said, yep, okay, great, just sign it and we'll try it.
Well, Paula Reed, Claire Finkelstein, and Stephen Vladeck, stand by here for just a moment. We are talking about the president's national emergency declaration and what's likely to happen next, both legally and politically. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about President Donald Trump's declaration of a national emergency on the southern border and the legal challenges that are being mounted against it and the political implications of the president's declaration. I'm joined today by Paula Reed, CBS News correspondent covering the Justice Department, the White House, and legal affairs. We're also joined by Claire Finkelstein. She teaches law and national security at the University of Pennsylvania and is director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. And Stephen Vladeck also joins us. He is a constitutional lawyer and professor at the University of Texas School of Law. And about this question of whether or not or what kind of political precedent the president of the United States is setting, here's what President Trump himself had to say to that on Friday.
The people that say we create precedent, well, what do you have, 56 or a lot of times? Well, that's creating precedent. And many of those are far less important than having a border. You don't have a border, you don't have a country.
That's President Donald Trump, and the 56 he refers to there are previous declarations of national emergencies. Stephen Vladeck, let me turn back to you here for a moment, because a lot of people are pointing to a particular moment in Supreme Court history as perhaps one of the guides that will be used as these cases against the national emergency make their way through the court system. This is the Youngstown test from the 1952 decision, Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company versus Sawyer. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because this is one case in which presidential power was limited because the court found it going against the expressed or even, as the court said, the implied will of Congress. So what is the Youngstown test here?
So, I mean, the Youngstown case is one of these famous canonical Supreme Court constitutional law decisions from the middle of the Korean War, where President Truman nationalized steel mills to avoid the consequences of a general strike and the sort of fall off in steel production that would have followed in the middle of 1952. He didn't have express statutory authority. I mean, he said that he had, implicit authority. He said, Congress, if you want to stop me, pass a new statute. But when the case gets to the Supreme Court, the court rules against Truman 6-3, holding that the fact that Congress hadn't expressly authorized the conduct was really a big part of what was going on. Now, the justices divided as to exactly where the line would have been. But in his famous and subsequently adopted concurring opinion, Justice Robert Jackson said, we really have to look at whether Congress has authorized what the president's done, whether it said nothing or whether it's failed to authorize and indeed repudiated what the president's done. The problem with applying that framework here, Meghna, is I think depending upon where you sit, you're going to see very different consequences. You're going to see very different sort of metrics for Congress here. So one way of looking at it is Congress has authorized this conduct through the National Emergencies Act and through this military construction statute. Another way of looking at it is Congress hasn't, because it only gave the president $1.3-some-odd billion for his wall. And so I think that's why Youngstown here is really not going to necessarily tell us anything other than, you know, confirming our priors.
Oh, interesting. So, Claire Finkelstein, do you agree with that? I mean, because I think the most significant difference is the statutory authority that Congress did give to the president in the subsequent decades.
Yeah, actually, I disagree with it because I think Youngstown is an excellent analogy here. Indeed, right down to the takeover of private property, since there are landholders along the border whose property will have to be taken and there are going to be fights on the use of eminent domain. So here the president is, you know, purporting to have an emergency that requires him to take over private property to build a border wall. And I think that the pushback from Youngstown and its progeny that really suggests there's a basis for limiting executive authority even in times of war, because this was actually during the Korean War, is very significant where that's involved. Those will probably be the strongest cases. There are also other principles that might lead the court to use a Youngstown-like analogy, such as the posse comitatus principle that says that military troops should not be used for civilian law enforcement. And that's essentially what this is. So again, on the second half, the uses of the funds, I think the claims will be stronger than on the first half. But I still think that there's an argument to be made that when it's a transparently sham emergency, then Youngstown suggests that we ought to read this action as inconsistent with the purpose behind the National Emergencies Act.
Mm. Well, back to the phones we go. Let's go to Tony, who's calling from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just want to kind of give a common sense viewpoint, if I may. I am a conservative, but I've also lived overseas and had to go through immigration a lot. I live in New Mexico. I live in a border state. I can tell you that this is a wall that would be good for all of Americans. Now, I know once I get off the phone, the legal experts will chew up my arguments. My point is, this shouldn't be something that should be politicized. We all know we need it. We all know the immigration is crazy. I live in Albuquerque. I can tell you that it's one of the meth capitals of the United States. And automobile theft is extremely high. This is something that has been needed for a very long time, and nothing works apart from this. And so I really think that, you know, we ought to pick our battles. And I don't think this is one that we need to pick. True, it was one of Trump's campaign promises, but it was one of the reasons that he got duly elected.
Yeah.
Now, like the guy or don't like the guy, personality-wise, I don't care for him. I think he's brash. Do I like what he's done since he's been in office? Yes. I actually didn't vote for him until the general election. So I've been really impressed. Okay, I get it. I get it. You may have differences of opinion, but this is a common sense thing.
Well, Tony, and, you know, Tony, I'm going to take it back from you there, and thank you so much for your call. That's Tony from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Let's get a different view here. Let's go to Charles, who's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Charles, you just heard Tony there saying the wall and appropriating funds or moving funds to support a wall is a common sense solution. Charles, what do you think?
Hi, thanks for having me. I disagree. Honestly, you know, maybe that's an emergency for his immediate area, but I don't believe that's a national emergency. I'm 29 years old. I'm a veteran and a registered nurse. I work hard for a living. Our schools, American public school system, is an emergency. The American water infrastructure is an emergency. You know, I'm looking at $150,000 in loans to get my doctorate in nursing, and I'll be paying those off for years to come. I voted for Trump in 2016 because I was tired of red versus blue. I was tired of career politicians. You know, I was between Bernie Sanders and Trump for that reason. You know, I figured one of the two, they weren't in corporate America's pocket. And I want to say that according to my peers, you know, I work nights. We were talking about this issue last night. He's lost our vote. A lot of us were moderate, maybe would have gone left, and we went with him because we wanted something different.
Yeah.
And he's lost us. We are tired of the abuse of power. It seems like Nixonian bullying tactics, and we're over it.
Right.
You know, you will not have our vote in 2020.
Well, Charles, thank you so much for your call. Paula Reed, let me turn back to you on that. I mean, Charles, really interesting set of calls there, actually. What do you think about that? And then we haven't actually explored the, you know, people around the country, but probably most especially in Washington, are concerned about the political precedent this action may set. And if it goes through, then, you know, what's to stop a future president from using national emergency powers for, say, declaring a national emergency on climate change?
Sure. And that's something the Democrats have tried to hammer home. Interestingly, the president's chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, argued that the president wasn't setting a precedent by doing this, which makes no sense at all. But that was one of their talking points. Clearly, if the president is successful, though, the precedent isn't set by him. It would be set by the courts. I mean, this is going to be challenged in court, and it's up to the Supreme Court whether or not to greenlight this and whether or not to approve this as a valid use of his national emergency declaration. Now, the whole idea of the border not being a political issue, that it's common sense, it's certainly one of the reasons the president got elected. But it does become political because you need to get the money from somewhere. And as you saw, Congress, the legislative process, they didn't give the president as much money as he believes is necessary. And he went ahead and he signed the deal anyway. And that's where he got a lot of pushback from conservatives. Sean Hannity called this deal, quote, garbage, and told him to shut down the government again and keep fighting until you can get this money through the proper legislative channels. Because I think a lot of people know at the end of the day, he's probably not going to be successful in holding on to all of these other funds that he has tapped into. And I think that's going to be another place where you see blowback for him in 2020. People are going to say, hey, you promised us a wall, you signed this crappy deal, and then you couldn't get this through the courts.
Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting. The Washington Post had this really terrific paragraph where they said, wherever the courts land, wherever they land, it will make history. If the court strikes down the president's action or upholds it, justices will be redefining presidential power. If they even refuse to consider the merits of the challenges, deciding instead that it is a political question, as we've been discussing, the court, that action could foreclose future challenges against presidents who might want to go even further. So we'll see what happens. But Paula, Claire, and Stephen, if I could, in the last, you know, 5 or 6 minutes that we have here, there's another story that I want to turn to and get all your views on really quickly. And that is what Andrew McCabe, the former acting director of the FBI, said on 60 Minutes last night, because a lot of people are talking about it. So Andrew McCabe described how Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, as we remember, how Rod Rosenstein raised the possibility of invoking the 25th Amendment of the Constitution to remove President Trump from office. So we're going to talk about the significance of that. But first, let's listen to what McCabe said on 60 Minutes.
Rod raised the issue and discussed it with me in the context of thinking about how many other cabinet officials might support such an effort. But to be fair, it was an unbelievably stressful time. I can't even describe for you how many things must have been coursing through the Deputy Attorney General's mind at that point. So it was really something that he kind of threw out in a very frenzied, chaotic conversation.
So that's Andrew McCabe last night on 60 Minutes. Paula, Claire, and Stephen, I want to get all your views here. But Paula, this is totally your wheelhouse. So let me just start with you. You know, we have Senator Lindsey Graham saying that he wants to investigate what he calls the possibility of an administrative coup coming out of the FBI. So what did you make of what McCabe had to say last night?
Well, I've talked to other sources who were in some of these meetings where the idea of wearing a wire and the 25th Amendment were raised. And no one denies that these were brought up, but no one says he was serious. They're like, look, these were just things that they were spitballing. They were joking. This was not serious. Because if Rod Rosenstein, an extremely smart, politically savvy individual, was serious about either one of those things, he wouldn't have said this in mixed company. He barely knew Andrew McCabe at the time. And anything that Andrew McCabe says, we have to remember the backstory here. He was fired from the FBI, not by the president, but after an internal investigation found that he lied repeatedly in the course of an investigation. Now, Jeff Sessions fired him right before he would have been eligible for his pension, so he is trying to sell books. He needs to make money to support his family. He has an axe to grind, clearly. He's not happy with some people. And I think that we have to remember that. He was one of the few people in the room where it happened, so we want to listen to his interpretation of these extraordinary events. But inside the Justice Department, a lot of people are asking, why on earth are you going public and talking about one of our most sensitive, high-profile investigations before it is over? Hmm. How can we go and tell, you know, rank-and-file FBI investigators, you can't leak, you can't talk about this stuff publicly? The way he's going about this, it does not serve the FBI or the Justice Department well, because he's an easy target for the president and anyone else who wants to undermine the legitimacy of the FBI.
Right. So, but Stephen Vladeck, let me turn to you, though, because I remember not just what McCabe said, but there was that, you know, that anonymous op-ed in the New York Times last year from some senior level White House person who also acknowledged that there was maybe initially some talk or whispering of invoking the 25th Amendment here. So are the circle of supporters around the president right to say, well, hey, maybe we should actually, you know, what Paula's source is saying, notwithstanding, we ought to take this more seriously?
I mean, I think that's the real headline here. I understand that, you know, the politics of it are, you know, should McCabe be talking publicly? How is this getting out? Are you really sort of acting in the best interest of the investigation? But let's step back for a second. I mean, if this really happened, and this is now confirming that it did, despite earlier reports suggesting that maybe that wasn't true, this is a deputy attorney general who was nominated by this president and who was confirmed by a Republican Senate taking these steps. That is a stunning, I think, story. And it's one that I think we should not lose sight of, that there are people who the president himself appointed to these senior positions who are privately expressing grave concerns about his fitness for office. I mean, we talk about what's unprecedented. I'm not familiar with a prior episode where we had senior appointees of the current president, you know, having conversations even behind closed doors, even that weren't meant to get out into the limelight, about whether the president was constitutionally unfit for office. And so for all the talk about a coup, I think it's worth stressing part of why Section 4 of the 25th Amendment exists is for a scenario where the president is not just physically or mentally incapacitated, but is actually somehow unable for whatever reason, in the view of the majority of his cabinet, in the view of Congress, to discharge the duties of his office. We ought to be having a serious conversation about why so many people are so concerned about this point. And if Senator Graham, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, wants to have a hearing, let's have a hearing about that and why there are so many officials who have that view.
Was that you,
Can
Paula?
Can I jump back in here?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, we have to remember, McCabe walked back his own statement. I mean, he said there were no extensive discussions. He was not privy to them. That anonymous op-ed, you know, if you read that op-ed, we still don't know who wrote it. It's pretty glowing of the president. Very few things would help consolidate the president's supporters than the idea of a coup. And this is now a Republican talking point. I think we have to be skeptical about the idea that they were sitting there counting noses and counting heads. No one in their right mind would have thought that the cabinet in May of 2017, Jeff Sessions, John Kelly, Steve Mnuchin, would seriously think of ousting the president. Certainly not anyone as smart as the people sitting in their room. I think we have to be skeptical, you know, about the idea that this was a serious undertaking.
Right. Well, we know. Stephen, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but we've just got about 45 seconds left, and I do want to give Claire a chance to give us her view. Go ahead.
Well, the
Claire.
Connection between the two stories we're talking about today is that rambling press conference with the sort of sing-song recitation of what's likely to happen in the courts was Exhibit A for the 25th Amendment. Politically, is it likely to happen? I don't think it is likely to happen. I think impeachment is actually more likely because I don't think the cabinet will get together and get rid of the president on 25th Amendment grounds. However, the deeper issue is the fact that all of this creates distraction that the president wants. It's no accident that we have, you know, the Manafort sentence recommendation and Roger Stone and everything that's coming out on that side at the same moment that the president is making this enormous battle over funding for his wall. Well, it gets us all talking about the wall all weekend rather than talking about what's happening in the investigation.
Well, got to wrap up this hour. Claire Finkelstein, Stephen Vladeck, and Paula Reed, thank you so very much. This is On Point.